Journey.
Hopefully for Greg Norman. Yes, well done. He's done it at last. Greg Norman, 69. And great stuff. The champion for 1986.
This week's guest met his wife when he was 2 years old. He went to the Open Championship while backpacking through Europe, slept on the beach at St Andrews, then ended up playing in the Open Championship at St Andrews. He mostly played in Europe, Australia and Japan. He lost his game pretty much completely, which we'll talk to him about. He's been a club pro. He became a reputable coach and still is today. All-round nice guy. My mate, welcome, Ken Trimble.
Thanks, Whit.
Okay, KT. So let's start at the start with you. Born in Young?
Yes.
Grew up in Narendra?
Correct. Yeah, my mother and father, they worked on a station at Crowther.
Yep.
And when I was born, I was born in Young Hospital. And soon after, or a couple of years after, Mum and Dad moved to Narendra to work on another farm in Narendra. That's where my mother's parents lived.
Right. Okay. And you said your dad was a station hand. Mum was a housewife.
Yes.
How many siblings?
Five of us all together.
Five kids.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Where do you sit in there?
I came along second. So I have an elder sister, two younger brothers, and a younger sister.
You met Kim, your wife, when you were 2 years old.
That's right. And her parents were visiting Narendra on the odd occasion and visiting my mother-in-law's parents who were living three doors from my mum and dad.
You didn't ask her out on the straight away, did you? You went dating from two.
She left me for 22 years, came back when she was 24.
Mm. Did you have the mo back? You didn't have the mo back then, did you?
My mo, that was born on August the 4th, 1982 at 9 a.m. in the morning.
Now,
and it's been there ever since.
I'm upset you've told me that because I've got it written here. Look at this. August 4, 1982 at 9 a.m. And leaving Krensdorf.
Correct. You've done some research.
This is my first one, so I've got to make sure it's impressive. Let's talk a little bit about your golf. So you started playing golf when you were 13?
Well, I started playing when I was 13. I was introduced to the game at 12 and a half.
Yep.
And a friend of mine at school caddied at Narendra Golf Club, and he told me he earned $2 on the weekend.
Beautiful.
And I thought, well, I've got to get amongst that. And so we lived 3 kilometres from the golf course, so we walked out one morning on a Saturday, and I secured a job with a local solicitor and made $1.20, can of drink and a packet of chips. That was my caddy fee.
So what happened to the $2?
$2, he had a better employer.
Oh, you're kidding. You only got $1.20.
No, a can of drink and a packet of chips.
Oh, as well.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds about $2. That's all right. Mm-hmm. Did you ever back it up?
Well, that's what got me into golf, pretty much. That was what made me, I guess, love the game initially, because there was a 2-round event. It was a 36-hole event, and I went out to caddy, and I just secured my handicap. So I just started playing. A guy showed me how to grip it, and I got a handicap of 24. I was going out to caddy to earn $5 for the day.
Really? 36 holes?
For the 36 holes. Anyway, this fella said, no, you're not caddying today. You're playing. And he actually paid my entry fee to play.
So you went to caddy?
Yes.
And ended up teeing it up?
I did. Reluctantly.
Wow. That's cool, though. Nice bloke. You remember him?
Reg Hyde. He drove an old E.H. Holden, a blue one, and with Venetian blinds in the back. I'll never forget it. And however, he said, you're playing today. And I was really cheesed off. I wanted to earn my $5. And unbeknownst to me, that 36 holes was the last 2 rounds of the club championship, and also they ran a Calcutta. So they actually bet on players. And I shot 88, 87, 64, 63 net.
Oh, you won it.
And I won the day. The people that bought me gave me 10%, which was $32.
Oh,
yeah. So I've walked home at 3 kilometres with 5 trophies and $32.
Wow. Thought, this game's not that hard. I went for $5. I earned 32 as a player.
Yeah. So that was my intro, which,
That's a good story. Never trust a man with Venetian blinds in the back of his car.
And a hat.
Mm. Good guy. What was his name again?
Reg Hyde.
Let's go back. One story I missed. You told me once about there was a girl that used to get to church, I think you said, at the Catholic school. Did you go to the Catholic school?
St. Joseph's Convent.
Yeah, St. Joseph's. And she used to get there first. She was always first there. Tell us the story.
Oh, no, it was our class mass. It was on a Tuesday morning, 7 a.m.
Yep.
Each morning. And her name was Tricia Sloan. Anyway, she was the teacher's pet. Hi, Tricia, if you're listening. Anyway, every Tuesday at school, the nun would say, well, Tricia was the only one at church this morning. So I made it a vow one night. I'd say, I set the alarm. I'm going to go to church as well at 7 in the morning. So I set this old alarm. It didn't have a glass face on the old alarm clock, but it had bent hands from being dropped so many times. Anyway, during the night, I think the big hand caught the little hand or vice versa. Anyway, it went off at 2 in the morning and I just jumped on my bike and rode up to the church and I'm waiting outside the door. I'm looking up at all these stars. There's no one around. Anyway, I thought, man, I haven't seen those stars before. Anyway, I must have stood there for half an hour and no one came. And then I rode my bike back home, jumped into bed, didn't even know what had happened, and went back to sleep, missed the alarm, but it didn't go off anyway. And got up for school and the nun that day said, well, Tricia was the only one at church this morning.
That's not true. You could say I was first here.
Who would have believed me?
No one would have believed you. You're right. Your dad, you said he was a heavy drinker when you were young.
He was. He was a very, very hard worker. And, yeah, we always had food on the table, but yep. he used to drink a lot.
But a good dad.
Oh, great fella. I never really got to know him until later on. In fact, he was a good golfer as well.
Yeah.
He lived in Sydney and he was, a four handicap, if I recall. But unfortunately, I never got to play golf with him.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? To think that you ended up, you know, a great player and your dad's off a four handicap. And so tell us a little bit about, you said you didn't get to know him until later on. Why was that? Is that because he was working so hard on the farm?
Working so hard and away he had shift work jobs. He was away building bridges. He had various jobs. And so we never, ever got to spend a lot of time with Dad.
Yeah,
and,
right.
I think is sad. However, that's the way it was.
Yeah, that's life. Yeah.
You know, those days the pubs had blocked out windows. So, you know, so people couldn't see who was drinking in the
really?
Pub.
Really?
So, that was me. No, that was life. That was life in the country.
Tell me a funny story about your dad. I can't remember it exactly, but you've told me once before on the roof or something. They had to call the hot roof or...
Well, Dad used to home brew. He started a home brew, which interestingly I have as well, so I'm following in his footsteps. But one particular day I wasn't in town at the time, however... Dad was home brewing in the backyard and it was 45 degrees. It was a hot summer's day. There was a tree in the backyard that Dad used to have his home brew kit underneath. And Mum called out from the back door. My dad's name's Ken. She said, Ken, the air conditioner stopped working. And our air conditioner was on top of the roof, on this corrugated iron roof, on the apex of it.
Yeah.
So Dad had quite a few drinks at the point in time and he hadn't done up the Dunlop volleys either that he was wearing, and he put the steel ladder up against the wall, climbed onto the roof. It was 45 degrees outside, as I said. Anyway, he went up to the top and fixed the air conditioner, then slid down. The Dunlop volleys came off, and his feet are now burning on the hot tin roof. Anyway, he was screaming out, but Mum was inside listening to the telly. She couldn't hear a thing. And one of the neighbours heard him and called the ambulance. And then they called the fire brigade. Then another ambulance down, police station over the road. So the police vehicle, two ambulances, the fire engine hosing him down.
Did you ever talk to him about that later on?
I did. He just laughed. But he used to – he was an old trooper. I mean, he had a tough upbringing. He was an orphan as a kid and so he did the best he could.
Yeah, right. Did it tough.
He did it tough.
So you're now a golfer. By this stage, you're a golfer because you've played in that event, so you must have – when did Ron Luxton and the Rothmans come to town?
Oh, that wasn't long after. That was – Ron came to town and with the Rothmans National Sports Foundation. So he used to run clinics two or three times a year, and that inspired a group of us to play the game, and we all became competitive and that – we never had a pro in the town. So yeah. Ron was our only connection to the outside world, if you like, for as a, you know, from a golfing perspective. Not like Santa Claus coming to town, but it was like a, you know, a fellow from the city coming to our country town, and it was fantastic. And it just inspired all of us. And, you know, a number of juniors progressed on to making careers out of the game from that.
Like how many golf pros came out of Narendra?
I believe there were six, but I think there's a seventh. A fellow who was coaching in Germany by the name of Frag Foley came out of Narendra. But other than that, we Narendra produced six pros to my knowledge, and I think that'd be almost unprecedented from a small country town without a professional golfer.
Amazing. I remember when I went to some Christmas camps, they were called, at Narrabeen, at the sports academy there. I think New South Wales Golf Association.
Now, you're not bringing up this story about the sandwiches, are you?
No, but I want to hear it because, no, but so you've dubbed yourself in there. I was going to say, I remember the pros like Larry Kenning and Chris Hearn, Mal Wilson, these guys, Laurie Montague, and I was only like 10, 11. I'd go down and sit on the fence because they'd be practicing. So they'd finish coaching or doing what they did for the day and they'd be hitting balls. And I'd go down and sit on the fence and I got to sit within 5-10 meters of a golf pro and they had their big tour bags and they were hitting balls. We can never underestimate the impact that you have on kids. Doesn't matter what sport it is or what you do. As I said to a group of kids recently doing a junior clinic, I won a golf ball when I was a kid. And that was like crazy. I want a ball. You know, it would have been worth a dollar. But to me, it was worth $1 million, which is you won. No wonder you're a much better player than me. You took $32 home and five trophies.
At one of those Narrabeen camps, Jack Newton and Billy Dunk, yeah, played an exhibition match at Cromer. And, yeah, just one of the great things I remember about those camps. You know, we used to catch the Southwest Mail train, which stopped at every station to get to Sydney to attend those camps.
Jack Newton and Billy Dunk, that would have been good.
Mm.
Edwina Kennedy came and did an exhibition. Do you remember her?
Yes.
Whatever happened to her? Edwina Kennedy. She was a good player, like Australian amateur.
Member of the Australian. I think she was captain of the Australian Golf Club. Really? Or was at one stage.
So what about the sandwiches?
Oh, we were bad boys. Bruce Harris and myself. Bruce was from Hay and we got together and we decided we're a little bit older. So we thought, oh, we'd like to share the beers of the instructors as well. So we, while they're out, one day we decided to sneak in and have ourselves a beer and we got caught.
Oh, did you?
So the next day we had to make, I think we made about 350 sandwiches the next day.
That's not bad punishment for having a few beers. If I would have known, I would have got a couple of beers. I would have made 300 sandwiches. No problem at all. Now, fruit picking, you're still in Narendra. You're still a country boy.
Yes.
You wanted to get some extra cash.
Well, St. Joseph's Convent, that only went to year 10. So, well, sorry, St. Joseph's Convent for us actually finished in year 7. So the nuns were good enough to convince Mum to send us to St. Francis College in Leeton, which we attended, and which only went to year 10. And after that, I decided that school wasn't for me, so I decided to not continue my education and decided to take up a job fruit picking. And I went with my prospective brother-in-law and we went for 2 weeks of fruit picking and I earned $11 a day filling up bins with fruit. And I just thought, well, hang on a minute, this is
a lot of work for 11 bucks.
A lot of work. I should have thought then the golf was for me.
What was I going to say? Leeton, we only found out 6 months ago that you were good mates with my first cousin, Chris Woods.
We went to school together.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? I wanted to take a short break from the show to let you know about our friends at Brisbane East, Gold Coast and Sydney South Commander Business Centres. If you own or run a business, let them do a health check on your business communications. The worst thing that could happen is you find out that your current deal is okay. And if you sign up at one of these three centres, you'll receive a 50-inch plasma TV. Offering Ericsson LG solutions. Contact one of these Commander Business Centres today. You get your way to Sydney. What brought that about?
It stems back from that time fruit picking because I did then decide to go to year 11 and year 12 at Narendra High School.
Right.
And they were staging a golf event there, so I thought I'd join that event. And I won the local event and then progressed on to the regional.
Right. So off to Sydney.
Well, that's when I figured that, yeah, there may be a future for me in the game, because I won the regional event and then progressed on to the state final of the match play. But along the way, I also travelled to Concord and on the Southwest Mail train again, which we used to frequent.
Yeah.
And Ron Luxton picked me up at Central Station and drove me to Concord. That was my first experience at the club when he drove me. It was in May 1978. And we drove down that Palm Line Drive to the course. It was a foggy morning. And I won the combined high schools championship.
Your first visit to Concord.
Mm.
And didn't know that there was a whole lifetime, well, pretty much at least probably half your life to be spent there in the next 20, 30 years.
Well, 40 years, exactly.
Amazing.
Mm.
Okay, so you moved to Sydney. What was that like? Was that I've never lived in the country. Growing up in the country, was that scary? Did you want to go home? Did you get homesick?
Well, Ron Luxton encouraged me to move to Sydney to progress my golf career. He obviously realised I had a talent for the game and secured me a job at PGF, which was a great company to work for in the sense that they took on young golfers like myself who were trying to, you know, move on with their golf career.
Yeah.
And Alan Davidson was a member of Concord Golf Club and he was also the boss of the Rothmans National Sports Foundation. And so Ron asked Alan if he'd join me at Concord. So they joined me at Concord as a junior and I moved down. I rode my Honda XL250 motorbike to Sydney.
Really? From Narendra?
And a friend of mine, a great friend of mine, Anthony DeVries, who is from Ardlethan, real a good friend, and he had my luggage in the back of his car while I rode the bike.
Wow.
So, and that's how I used to get around to golf events as well. I used to, I had this prized Ben Hogan 10-inch brown and green golf bag, and I used to put it across my knees to get to golf events. It was, rather illegal, but...
Oh, well, there probably wasn't against the law back then.
Wasn't it?
There was probably no... What year were we talking? 1940, what was it? There was no laws back then when you were playing Varden events.
That's probably right. That's how I got my driver's license. Well, anyway.
So you had... I'm just picturing you. This is primo. This is just primo.
This is primo.
Just.
Yes.
Just. Driving, I'm just picturing you with your... with your helmet on, your golf gear, the Hogan bag on your lap.
That's it.
And the little Honda flying up I love it.
Yeah, I parked at all the private clubs. It was a good look.
I love it. Well, yeah, good on you. Now, tell us about the 1980 Queensland Open. You're an amateur? Do you reckon you're an amateur? Oh, you were an amateur because you hadn't started your traineeship yet. And... you played with a little skinny left-handed kid.
Well,
we're 99% sure.
I'm not sure now.
Really?
No, I'm not sure.
You're backtracking. Let's give it 90% sure.
Okay. I played with this little.
He's never going to listen to it, mate. Don't worry about it. So let's go 95% sure.
Anyway. It sounds like one of my dad's tall stories. Anyway, I'll tell you about that in a minute. But it was 1986 and I played the Queensland Open at Tweed. I played this bespectacled left-hander from Canada. And I was hitting it 40 to 50 past him. And at one stage there, not that I've ever thought that about too many people. I was thinking everybody's got a possibility to further their career, obviously. I thought, oh, geez, I don't think this guy's got much hope. Anyway, he disappeared for a while and he came back on the scene and I was progressing my career. And then I took the club job at Concord and I said to my staff, I mistakenly said to my staff, I shouldn't have ever mentioned it, that I played with this kid named Mike Weir in Queensland. Anyway, So each day they'd look at me when I could win a tournament or he's playing at Augusta and winning, and they'd say, Ken, what are you doing now?
That's gold though, isn't it?
It was priceless. But anyway, I must check up on whether it was actually my, I thought it was Mike anyway. But
we're going to confirm it.
We should.
We're going to assume it's correct for now. Robbie Willis told me that he played with a left-hander as well in Perth, I think he said, years ago. And he couldn't break 80, this kid. And it was Nick O'Hearn. And oh, wow. he couldn't, mm-hmm. you know. And if you've read, I don't know if you've read Nick's book, it's a great book, but he talks about, you know, he couldn't play and then he sought the services of a sports psych and got his head and routines and everything right. But similar thing. He couldn't, struggling with his game. Got it together. So the next step, you're about 20 at this stage and you make your way over to Europe with a mate, backpacking.
Correct.
Tell us about that.
That's a long story.
That's good. We've got a lot of time. So give us the short version, because you end up, it's pretty amazing. You've told me a little bit about it, but I want the listeners to hear, because you end up working for a photographer, you end up at an open championship,
mm-hmm.
you sleep on the beach at St. Andrews. They're great stories. They've got to be told.
Well, it goes back to year 7.
Yep.
There was a person who was the catalyst for me going to Europe, and she was an Austrian girl. Her name is Teresa, and we started writing to each other in year 7. Anyway,
where'd she come from? Where do you know her from?
A pen pal.
It was pen just
a
pal.
Scheme they had.
I had one too. Yeah.
Write to people all over the world and get introduced and whatever. So I
you had the hots for this Austrian girl.
Well, I assume so.
Yeah.
I think I remember so. Anyway, I moved to Sydney, and coming from a small country town, it was very difficult to acclimatise to city life. And I was living on Liverpool Road at Ashfield in this small dog box of a unit. My auntie and uncle both smoked, and it was pretty ordinary. And I was parking my XL250 underneath the building, riding to PGF, working there, coming back to Concord if I had the time to do a little practice. So city life for me wasn't what I expected it to be. And she wrote a letter to me one time, said, why don't you come over for Christmas?
Really?
So I wasn't enjoying Sydney at all. And I said to my best mate, his mate Damien, who was a motor mechanic in Narandra, I said, would you like to go to Europe? And he said, oh, you won't have enough money to go to Europe, because I was only earning $116 a week at PGF.
Yeah.
And, you know, the airfare was $1,709. I still remember it.
Wow.
And, of course, the sleeping bag on top of that had to be a good one. But anyway, we decided to embark on this European trip. So I took a job at South Sydney Juniors, cleaning every night, so raise enough money to pay for my airfare and also have a bit of cash in hand. So I had $4,500. So I was shooting off to Europe for a year. So shelving golf altogether. But there was a fellow at Concord Golf Club named Albert Wallace, who was the secretary manager at the time. And once I said I was disappearing, or venturing overseas, I was actually fishing. I'd been fishing with my uncle for the day, and I'd come return to the unit. I only had a pair of shorts on, and he arrived at the door of the unit just dressed immaculately, as he always was. Concord blazer and tie, and he suggested he actually made a special trip to my unit to suggest that I retain my
membership,
non-playing membership, or overseas membership, whatever category it was, I can't remember. So I paid my $50 to remain at the club, and which was, sort of pivotal to me actually returning there when I came back from overseas. But anyway, but yes, we decided to venture overseas. So we were 20 years old, and thought we'd just, go and see the world.
That's cool. I remember Albert Wallace when I first started working at Concord cleaning clubs, or maybe my first couple of years there. He had the heaviest putter. Do you remember that putter?
He got it from Billy Brask.
Do you remember the putter?
I do.
It was the heaviest putter you've ever seen.
It was extraordinary. But he convinced me that it was great because he just kept selling it to himself.
Yeah, and he three-putted every green. But he loved this putter. Who's Billy Brask?
Oh, an American tour player who played at the New South Wales Open one year.
Oh, right.
He might have thrown the putter away. That's why Albert picked it up.
He was. I had a lot of time for Albert. Mm. He was pretty intimidating for me. I was a young kid. I was like 16, and he was the general manager at Concord Golf Club. But he was as straight as the day is long, like honourable man. I had a lot of time for him.
Yeah, one of my first telegrams that I opened when I played in the Open one year was from Albert.
That's cool.
And I'll never forget that.
Yeah. And the fact that he came to your unit – you've been out fishing and he's got his gear on. He's come to do the, to do the right thing by you. It's awesome. I want to backtrack for 1 second. You were living in Narrandera because we're about to get into golf tournaments, but it wasn't the first tournament. You caught a mail train from Narrandera and got your way to Sydney in the 78 Aussie Open at the Australian.
Exactly, yeah. My mate and I, he just got his license. So that's Damien, and we're in Narrandera. We decided we want to go to a golf tournament in Sydney. So the Australian Open was being played at the Australian Golf Club. I'm quite sure it was 78. And anyway, we had to hightail it to June E to catch the train. And we're running late, so I think he had pushing over 160 k's an hour on the country roads to get there. Anyway. We caught the train and stayed at my auntie's place, went out to the Australian Open. But we thought, well, we've got to get inside the ropes. We don't want to be watching from the crowd. Yeah. So we went to the marshal tent, asked if we could secure a job, which we did. They gave us a job as a marshal. And anyway, we spent 4 days watching the golf from inside the ropes. They had a rain delay. We're out there mopping up the water in the 80th green with the towels, and it was great. And then we went to the party afterwards. Jack Nicklaus came down and thanked us all. And
really?
Oh, it was really cool.
And Nicklaus won.
Yes.
Nicklaus won that. Do you know he won 4 Australian Opens in the 70s, Nicklaus? 3 of them were at the Australian, and the 4th... If you can guess it, I'll buy you a expensive bottle of wine.
Where he won his 4th?
Yeah, in the 70s. He won at the Australian, and?
Not Manly.
No. It's not in Sydney.
Oh, okay.
Have another guess.
I'm out.
Royal Hobart.
Oh, okay.
Because when I was reading up some of this stuff for you, I'm like, Royal Hobart, don't. So Nicklaus went.
He did shoot 62 at Manly,
yeah.
But that was in a New South Wales Open, was it?
He at Manly. The only story I remember from that is he shot in the 60s all 4 days, but he bogeyed the last all 4 days, the par 3.
Oh wow!
I remember when I was young reading the reading his scorecards, and it went like 64, 67, 62, 67. And he's gone bogey, 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 bogey on the par 3 last hole every day. Okay, so going back to Europe, KT, you end up, what came first, working for the photographer or going to St. Andrews? Because they were at different places, right? How did you end up working for a photographer?
Oh, we were backpacking around Europe. So we arrived in London, backpacked our way to Austria with a view to working in a ski resort, eventually meeting up with Teresa. And
it was all about this girl.
Well, kind of, yeah.
Still
no Mo.
But it's the Mo's coming.
Oh, you love this. Anyway, we got a job. I got a job as a barman in this 5-star hotel called the Tiffenbrunner. And I was actually dispensing balm to the waiters and waitresses because I couldn't speak the language. Anyway, we used to do the lunches, breakfasts, breakfast dinners, and then we'd ski every day pretty much between our shifts. And anyway, I'd been writing to this girl for 8 years, and she's coming out.
You've seen a photo?
Seen photos, but she's coming out from Krensdorf in Austria, a little village south of Vienna. So she's catching the train to Kitzbühel to meet up with me.
For the first time ever?
The first time. So anyway, we're having our last run down the hill, down the mountain. This is the last ski run of the day. Next day I'm meeting my pen pal. And I caught an edge and did a face plant. And I've got scabs on blood all over my face.
You dope. 8 years.
8 years.
Without scabs on your face. And the day before you meet her.
My face was swollen up. And anyway. But
what happened with Teresa?
Well,
she turned up.
She turned up. We had a really nice time, and she eventually went back home, and we still keep in contact. So, in fact, I spoke to her yesterday.
Really?
Yeah. So, a long-standing relationship, and when I played the Austrian Open, she came out to watch me play with her husband and so forth. So it was great.
So cool.
Mm.
I wrote to her. I had a pen pal when I was in primary school, and I can pretty much remember her name, but I haven't been able to find her. Anyway, so that's good. That's good. Go on to...
Yes, so after our season working, we bought a VW. So I've shot off to Europe with $4,500.
Yeah.
And we bought a car out of that as well. So we bought a car, my mate and I, out of our holiday pay, and... a little VW, so we traipsed all the way around Europe in that and over to the British Isles and with a view to ending up at the Open.
Is Damien a golfer?
Well, he was a 15 handicapper, but an amazing story. He's one of the guys that has been very inspirational to me. He's my best mate in what he's achieved in life, but... He was a 15 handicapper in Australia, but won a club championship in Holland where he now lives.
Right. But what I'm trying to work out is when you were backpacking, were you dragging him along to these golf things, or he was as keen as you to go?
Oh, as keen as me.
Right. I thought, this poor mate, you're dragging him everywhere.
Oh, no, I only play golf once in a year.
Oh, right.
Once in a year.
But you're still keen enough to go. I don't know when the the British Open at Troon pops in, but you got up that morning and thought, I'm going to wear this bright red jumper. I'll look amazing out there in this.
Yeah, well, we actually played St Andrews before we went to Troon, which I must tell you.
Yeah.
So we were pretty much doing Europe on $10 a day. So we had these sleeping bags that kept us cool or warm to minus 15 degrees and space blanket. So we'd sleep anywhere.
Yeah.
And so our decision was to play St Andrews. So we parked our car on the beach where they did Chariots of Fire, and we decided to sleep on the beach.
Wow.
The night before playing St Andrews. And so... we thought, well, we needed some golf balls, so we fossicked around in the heather on one of the holes and found a dozen balls each. And the next day we played St Andrews. It cost us £22 to hire the clubs and play the game. And I had blue joggers, green pants, and a brown shirt on. I looked terrible, but anyway, I got a lovely photo of shooting it down the last hole. But had 79, which wasn't bad after not playing for so long.
And... pretty much, if we skip forward 8 years later, you're teeing off in the British Open at St Andrews.
That's right. Exactly 8 years later, my name was called to the tee for the first round of the British Open by Ivor, and I just had this surreal vision of myself camping on the beach over there 8 years previous and thought there's a nice little rags to riches story.
And you slept in a nice hotel, the bed and electric blanket.
That's it.
Nice hot cup of tea.
Yeah, that's when we went to Troon. Went to Troon after that.
Yeah, so tell us about – well, let's go to Ivor for a second. You've got to miss that voice on the first tee.
Fabulous voice.
You've got to – oh, I was shattered. Well, he retired, what, 4 or 5 years ago, whatever it was. You missed that voice. To the first tee.
That's it.
Ken Trimble. So you get your way to back to the red jumper. I know you try to avoid it. Let's talk about the red jumper at Troon.
The red jumper, well.
Langer loved it.
Red Baron.
He loved it, didn't he? Langer loved it.
So Damien and I, having previous experiences as marshals in Australia, we decided to drive over to the British Open at Troon on the west coast. And we camped in someone's backyard, pitched our little tent, and went to the marshals area and registered for a job. And I secured a job with a photographer named Steve Powell from Sports Illustrated. And my job was to carry his 600mm lens with a monopod. So I was his caddy. And anyway, we're inside the ropes. Fantastic. And one particular occasion there on the 17th hole, Bernard Langer was putting. And I had this bright red jumper on with a little Australia badge. You know, I think Steve still got it. I left it with him, I think. But anyway, I crawled up the edge of the green, like one of those spectators that just shouldn't be doing what I was doing. But anyway, I crawled up to the edge of the green because I couldn't see the surface. But he's putting straight toward me, only a three-footer. And I finally got up there and he just looked at me and said, "Hey, you were in a red jumper, move," like this. Anyway, I just, you know, shyly went back down the hill and everyone's like, yeah, spotlights on the spectator or the, yeah.
Crawled under a rock.
Crawled under a rock, exactly. Anyway, he missed the putt and he just glared at me. Anyway,
that was your fault.
I figured it was
my fault.
Well, it is. Yeah.
He's trying to focus and make a three-footer in the British Open and you're flittering around the background with your
exactly.
bloody red jumper on. Aussies. Now, we're going to get to Langer later on because that's 82, right?
That's 1982.
And we're going to talk about it in a minute. In 85, he flies all the way to Sydney to get your help to help him with his putter, to adjust his putter. It was a long way to come, but you were the man to see. Anyway, we'll talk about that in a minute. So Tom Watson wins that tournament.
Well, Nick Price led by 4 at one stage. I think it was around the 12th hole where Steve and I had to race out to get some photos of Nick, and Nick had a pair of yellow pants on and just this fantastic hair, you know. He looked great. And
oh, Nicky Price.
Nicky Price, yeah. He looked
love
fantastic.
Nicky Price. That fast, that tempo of his.
Yeah, I think it was all of 24 years old at the time, if I remember.
Loved him.
He was ahead by 4, so it was just a great experience to see him play.
Him and Seve had a duel somewhere, and it was – I was only a kid. Seve had his Schlesinger logos on, and him and Nicky Price, they shot like 65, 66 or something somewhere. Oh, I'll never forget it. It was amazing. Okay, so do you remember who finished runner-up at Troon? There was Nicky Price finished second. Watson won. Who else finished second? You couldn't guess it.
I'd have to look at my
You couldn't
photos.
Guess it. I'll give you his initials and you won't get it.
Go on.
P.O.
Well, that's not Peter O'Malley, but Peter Oosterhuis.
Yes.
There you go.
He finished second. I was looking it up. I don't know all this stuff. I was doing a bit of homework. Okay, so you get back. See, it didn't take that long to talk about your Europe trip. Sounds like a great trip. You get back to Sydney. You're 22 now, roughly.
I arrived back, I was 22, I was 21 and a half.
Well, that's...
And I had $1,500, so in traveller checks, and all I owned was in a backpack.
And back to your auntie and uncle's unit?
Well, back to Naranda, actually. And we'd been to Egypt and Israel as well. And a funny story, I've got to tell you this. Anyway, we were in Egypt and Dame and I were dressed in just like shorts and a T-shirt. And we looked so out of place. So we decided to buy a caftan and jellyfish and a turban and anyway, dress like the locals do. Yeah. So we spent 2 or 3 weeks in Egypt just dressed as one of the locals. And it was, yeah, no one bothered us and was terrific. But I kept that garb and I travelled back to Narandra when I returned from Europe and I thought, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to dress up in my Egyptian gear.
That's a good anyway, idea.
My sister had told me that Mum was going to the hairdresser to get ready for my homecoming and anyway, but she thought it was the next day. So I was arriving a day before to surprise her, you see. So right. Anyway, whilst I was on the train, I put my caftan on and the turban and I had some brown boot polish and painted my face. Anyway.
You get in trouble for that these days.
Anyway. Oh, I've got to tell you this, though. I mean, when we backpacked around, we backpacked and right through the Sinai Desert. And my mate and I, we camped beneath Mount Sinai out in the open. And these two Egyptian fellows said, oh, would you like to come to our place? So they threw us in the back of a ute and drove us for about 30 minutes to this oasis. And I think today, I don't think I'd dare do the same thing. But but we had a most amazing time. This is before internet and all.
Yeah, whatever.
But it was an amazing time. But anyway, I'm on the train getting dressed in this caftan and turban and I thought, this is going to be funny. So, you know, people at Naranda don't often see an Egyptian, you know, person. Hopped out of the train station. My sister,
especially not a non-Egyptian Australian dressed up as one.
So, exactly, yeah. So anyway, I've walked down the main street of town and all these people are just looking and I'm just trying to stare straight ahead and I've gone straight into the hairdresser where Mum was having her hairdresser appointment.
Mm.
And I sat in the chair, arms folded like a, you know, a pharaoh. Anyway, I saw Mum look at me out of the corner of my eye and she said to the person doing hair, said, who is that? I didn't even recognise me.
Hadn't seen you for how long?
A year.
Oh, a whole year.
A whole year.
Hadn't seen her son for a year. So she started tearing up, I bet.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah,
she did.
Now, you must have already met Bruce Jackson. So for the people listening, tell us about Bruce Jackson, amazing fella.
Yeah. Well, Alan Davidson introduced me to Bruce.
Yeah. Who was Bruce? Who's Bruce Jackson?
Who was Bruce Jackson?
For the people at home, yeah.
Bruce Jackson was, he's a life member of Concord Golf Club now, but he was, in a lot of respects, a little like my father.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ronnie Luxton was my second father. Bruce would be my third father.
He was the club professional at Concord.
Yes, he spent 37 years as a club professional at Concord, and in that 37 years, he had 2 weeks holiday.
Amazing guy. When I was when I first started at Concord, I was cleaning clubs. I was about 16, and he used to turn up and play in the Wednesday comps with his tie on, his long sleeve shirt, his tie. Great old fella.
Well, I used to laugh because he'd wear brogue shoes and cuffed pants.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, that's so old fashioned. And then in the '90s, I was wearing the same.
That's
thing.
Right. Yeah, everything comes back.
It did.
That's
it
why
did,
you should.
It did.
You should keep your dad's wardrobe.
But one of the saddest things that I ever heard, and I think for any club professional, it's I think it's mandatory you spend time with your family, but. I decided to have Sundays off when I was the club professional there and on the basis that at Bruce's wake after his funeral, his four children approached me and said, can we think you knew Dad better than we did?
Right.
And I thought that was pretty sad.
Yeah.
He spent so much time in the job and
Yeah, well, a club professional gives up so much for their club, and it's often overlooked. You know, like people are. I was talking to I played golf yesterday with a guy that's been on a board at a golf club for, he's just finished up, but close to 20 years. And he was talking about, and it's so true, if the club pro has, let's say, Tuesday mornings off, if it's the only morning he has off, and for example, that's Ladies' Day, then you cop it because, you know, he's never at the club. Because the only time that person, you know, that lady, for example, plays at the golf clubs at that time on a Tuesday.
Mm.
So the pro or club pro, doesn't matter what day is off, if someone comes only to play golf on a Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, and that pro is the only time he has off all week's Friday afternoon, he cops it for that one as well. So I'm always defending the club pros. Okay, so Bruce Jackson, some of his famous – I remember him saying – we're lucky people.
35 times a day.
It never rains at Concord.
Yeah, born under a lucky star.
Born under a lucky star.
Yeah. If you don't win a ball, I'll give you one.
Yeah, that's right. Because I'd go, like I'm a kid cleaning clubs at Concord. By the way, I think I'm super privileged. I used to love it. I was at Concord Golf Club. And he'd turn up and I'd go and get his buggy for him. Because they told me he was the pro here forever, you know. And he's just a gentleman. So I'd go and get his buggy and, you know, he'd always greet you. We're lucky people. It never rains at Concord. Legend. I loved him. They tell me when he left and Kyle got the job there, the shop, they were finding balls from 1927 and stuff. Some of the stuff up on the old racks. And do you remember any of that?
Oh, there was a room with shirts that would have been from the 50s or 60s with these huge collars.
It was
amazing, the stuff he had.
That's funny.
But now he was – people put up with that, dealt with that because of the person he was.
Of course.
And that was most important to people. He treated everybody so well and he treated everybody the same. Mm. There was one great story when this fellow approached the little window where Bruce served from and he said – Bruce, I'd like to buy a white cap. And Bruce went out in the – we weren't allowed in the shop. We weren't allowed in the shop to clean up or anything. Just for some unknown reason, Bruce didn't want us in the shop. Anyway.
You weren't allowed in the pro shop. What do you mean?
We weren't in the showroom. So that was Bruce's domain. And
all right.
Our job was to clean clubs.
That was for the club professional, the front bit.
Yes. So he went out to the display area and picked up this cap and anyway, the fella said, no, Bruce, I want a white one. And he just whacked it on his legs. All the dust went flying over. He said, look, it is white.
It used to be white. When I bought it, it was white. That's funny. Now, you're a trainee professional. You did it a little bit. Like I finished my traineeship when I was 19. You started your traineeship at 22.
I was 22 and a half because when I arrived back in Australia from overseas, I missed the induction by a week. My sole purpose was to come back to play golf.
Yeah.
And I missed it by a week and therefore I, gravitated back to Concord and Bruce was looking for someone to work in the shop, which I decided to do. So I worked in the shop as an amateur or as a shop assistant, but playing golf at Concord as an amateur.
But you were already a good player, right? I'm assuming what handicap? Because you'd been over to Europe, so you were on a you hadn't played golf hardly at all for a year.
Glenn, I came back to turn pro, because I had a lovely lifestyle in Europe. Yeah, seasonal work and skiing away at these great resorts and so forth. And I thought I can't do this the rest of my life. So my decision was to return to Australia to do something with my life, and that all I knew was golf. And I returned and to Concord, and I couldn't stop shanking it for 3 months.
After your layoff?
After my layoff, I was shanking. I couldn't even get in the Concord pennant squad of 10 players.
Wow.
Couldn't even get in. So I was, you know, pretty ordinary.
And do you remember how you got out of that? Like just more golf.
Oh, look, I got a tip from one fellow, but I think it was just more practice. Golf. Mm.
The shanks.
Yeah, it was pretty hard. It was not just sand, it was with everything.
They're no good, shanks. Normally golf pros don't even say the word. Now, I was going to ask about, so you started your traineeship. You won eight consecutive trainee events.
Mm-hmm.
That's unbelievable.
It was,
there was only three trainees, surely. How many trainees were there?
We had a few good players.
Yeah. So you won eight events in a row.
Mm.
Do you remember what courses?
My first score as a trainee was 76 at Pimble. And, you know, in those days, as you know, if you secured a card, you know, sole purpose was get your cards in, you know. So I thought, wow, I've got a card in my first game. So 76. But I just found the transition from golf as an amateur to actually meaning something. Just gave me that greater purpose to want to go out and make a career of it. Plus also our trainee wage was very minimal. So, and at 22 and a half, I figured, well, I've got to try and supplement my,
get some more cash.
Mm.
Where were the eight wins at? Do you remember?
Oh,
you couldn't remember all eight.
I couldn't. I know North Ryde and also down at Camden Valley. And I think I could work back through it. I'll probably have it in the record books. Do you want me to go back home and get it?
Yeah. We'll just put you on hold for about 3 hours. So you win eight trainee matches in a row.
14 in the year.
And you won 14 in 1 year.
Mm.
Now it's starting to click that I might be able to make a living. I might be good enough. If I can beat these guys, I might be good enough to play this game for a living one day.
I think there were certain moments that made me think, yes, I could make a career out of it. And, as a trainee, that was certainly one when it had that succession of wins and also, moving on to the next year and winning the state championship and then following that up the following year and winning the Australian title as well, which
Now that one, that was at Duntree League?
That was at Duntree League.
And on the 16th, you hit a one iron to 6 feet.
Yeah, it was probably one of the shots I'll never forget. I was level pegging almost. It might have been one shot ahead of Mark Nash. And, this event, well, obviously the Australian title, but also meant it was the first time that the Australian PGA was sending a representative over to the US to play in the equivalent there or the US assistance. So there was a lot riding on it. And I was on the 16th, hit a great drive, and I took out my Titleist one iron and just rifled it straight at the flag to 6 feet. I think it's just one of those great shots. You know, you never forget.
And who was in the running? Like Lonard or?
I think Chris Rutherford. And Lonard was, yes, I played with Pete the last day, if I recall.
Yep.
He had canary yellow pants on.
Yep.
And he didn't hit it very far either, but he certainly changed that. Mark was in the group ahead, if I recall.
So you were back a bit, and that you didn't win it on the 16th, but that was
that was where it was clinched.
Oh, that was it.
Pretty much. I just had to go a couple of pars and easily won.
And you're in.
Mm.
So now you're winning four rounders, New South Wales trainees, mm-hmm. Aussie trainees. Mm-hmm. Then you head over to the US. Tell us about that. You said you win a trip. If you win the Aussie trainee champs.
That's right. And Max Garski, I think, had secured this deal with the US to take on an Australian player. And Qantas provided me with an airfare to LA. The tournament was in Brockton, Massachusetts. And they gave me the airfare to LA and an entry into the tournament. I had to find my own way, and that was quite a journey.
Cool, though.
It was great.
Great experience for you.
It was great. The dollar was at 59 cents and I loaded up with a little cash. And Albie Lewis, one of the members of Concord, had a friend in LA who he said, he'll look after you. Joe, I can't think of his last name. Joe will look after you. So he picked me up at LA airport. And I was thinking, you know, I was staying at his place, playing golf a couple of days and whatever. Anyway, he booked me into Riviera Country Club. So I got the bill after that. And I thought, whoa, I'm running out of money.
He got the bill. He charged you.
Oh, no. I thought I was staying at his place. We were staying at the Riviera. He booked me into the Riviera Country Club. Anyway, I hadn't accounted for that. And then the next day I wanted to go to Disneyland, so I went down and stayed at the Hyatt, and all of a sudden I'm cash-strapped already. Still had 10 days to go. And with my backpacking experience around Europe, I flew to Boston and thought, oh, well, okay, I've got to leg it down here to Thorny Lee Golf Club or find my own way. So I eventually found my way there, stopped at a fire station, asked them directions, and oh my God, it was a nightmare. But anyway, I arrived at the car park and I think, God, Trimble, you're useless. You haven't got enough cash. You know? Anyway, I ran into this fellow in the car park and he said, oh, you're one of the golfers here for the tournament, are you? And I said, yeah, that's me. And he said, oh, where are you from? I haven't heard that accent before. And I said, Australia. And he said, well, we haven't had an Australian here before. Where are you staying? And I said,
You said your place.
I said, I don't know yet. Well, I didn't have my sleeping bag, so I couldn't stay in that sleeping bag. But anyway, but no, he said, will you come and stay with me? And I thought, oh, fantastic. Beautiful. And I stayed 10 days with a guy named Dr. Lewis Abdu, who was marvelous Marvin Hagler's ringside physician.
Beautiful.
And we had the most amazing time. It was fantastic.
And saved you a fortune.
It did.
you would have been sleeping on the beach again.
Again.
Now, go back to Langer in 85, which would be around this time. Were you in your last year when you won the Aussie Trainee Champs?
That was my second year.
So 85, I don't know what year that was, but it doesn't matter. 85, Bernard Langer wins the Masters.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember he had red, all red on the final day, I remember.
Yes.
Because I was 12 then, right?
Oh, he was my idol.
Red pants, red shirt. Mm-hmm. He might have got the red from when he saw you in 82 at the – anyway.
I think he's got my jumper.
I think he's got your shirt on. Yeah. And he had the old putter up the forearm, anchored it against his forearm. Do you remember?
He didn't do that
then.
Yes, he did. Well, he'd not.
Check it up, Jim.
Yeah.
He did. He had the putter up the forearm like this. His left hand was about 12 inches from the putter head.
Right.
And he had that one happening, I'm sure.
Was that after he missed that short one of the Ryder Cup?
I'm sure. Yeah, it would have been. Yeah. And who wins the Masters after having the yips? It's not possible. The Greens are. Because he said he won. Well, he won two Masters, and I think he says both he'd had the yips previously, which is unbelievable. But he flies, Langer flies, wins the Masters in 85, flies all the way to Sydney to get you to fix his putter.
Yeah, he booked in.
Sort of, something like that. So what happened? He's playing the New South Wales Open at Concord.
Yes, and the pro shop at Concord, it was very old school, as was Bruce.
Yep.
And anyway, I was the only one in the shop at the time. Bruce was out, and Bernard walked into the pro shop. And
you would have been beside yourself.
Oh, I was.
Bernard Langer.
I was.
He just won the Masters.
Yeah, but he abused me at Troon.
But, well, he deserved it.
Oh, well, I did.
So that's all right.
That's true. But he walked into the pro shop and he had his putter in his hand and he just turned to me and he said, hello, my name is Bernard Langer. Can you put some loft on my putter, please?
I thought he was German.
Was that not German?
Oh, it was.
Oh, okay.
Anyways.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, that was the Austrian dialect.
Sounds like it.
Okay. Yep. Anyway, Bruce had this piece of timber that was fashioned from like a piece of 4x2 and or 3x2 probably. And he called a nulla nulla, so it even had a handle worn down on it. So I took Bernard's putter and put in the vice, and I'm about to hit it with this nulla nulla.
You better ruin it.
I know this is the International Golfer of the Year, the guy that just won the Masters, and I've got his putter, and I'm about to hit it with a block of wood. Anyway, he just said, oh, no, or nine, or whatever. So anyway, I said, well, yeah, my boss is back in half an hour or so. Why don't you come back in then? So, which he did, and he walked in with that peculiar, not peculiar, but that unusual gait of his. You know, it's quite rigid. And walked in, he introduced himself to Bruce Allen. My name is Bernard Lange. Is that better?
That's a lot
no,
better.
No, no, no. Okay.
And he probably said, someone that knows what they're doing, please adjust this putter?
Correct. Anyway, Bruce said, hello, Bruce Jackson. Nice to meet you, he said. And anyway, Bruce took the putter from Bernard, put in the vice before Bernard could say anything. He had the nulla nulla in the hand and smashed this putter a couple of times, pulled it out of the vice, held it up in front of himself and said, that should be better.
And what did Bernard say? Well, this is perfect.
Well, I think he did. He shot 63, so it must have been good.
Wow.
That was in the Pro-Am. He played with the Concord president that day.
Now, the nulla nulla, I didn't know it had a name, but a few things about that. We still had that. When I was a trainer at Concord.
Really?
Yep. That thing you're talking about, we still had it. We still had it. We used it. So it still lived at Concord. I don't know who's got it. But there's a photo. I've seen the photo of Bruce standing there with Bernard.
I actually have that photo. And the photographer from the Sydney Morning Herald, I believe, was present at the time, and he took that photo. And it's just something that's really precious to me because
it's great. Well, it's your idol and your idol, your third dad.
Exactly.
I've got to get a copy of that. I remember the photo. It's awesome. Is there a photo of Mr. Jackson in the clubhouse or locker room at Concord?
There's a portrait in the Concord room.
Beautiful. Okay, wanted to make sure it was. You finish your traineeship. You're a good player. You're engaged.
Yes.
You hit your girlfriend in the head. In the head?
Do you have to bring this up?
Where'd you hit her?
Well, in the forehead.
With a ball?
Yeah, well.
And then proposed to her the same week?
Pretty much.
That's terrible.
Well, there is a story to it.
That's terrible. Tell us.
Kim was caddying for me at the state trainee championships. And anyway, I wasn't driving it too well. And I went to the range and a good friend of mine, also a trainee from Concord, Brad Saunders, was watching me hit my driver, and anyway, Kim was out the back of the field just collecting the golf balls, and we had hand signals as we did in those days, you know, arm up, that's going straight at you, arm out the right, left, that's where it's going. Anyway, I hit this drive, and anyway, Kim couldn't see the ball, and I didn't put my arm up because I thought I'd miss her on the left, and I didn't want her to you know, move into it, and Brad said, oh, that'll miss her on the left. Next minute, oh, there's a mighty thwack.
Wow.
And, everyone went running toward her and a little hole in the head, blood loss, 7 stitches later, and she caddied the next day and I won.
So she got stitches.
7 stitches, yeah.
You hit her on the full?
On the full.
Oh.
On the full, yeah. Anyway, she's,
Scar?
A little scar, yeah. But when she was on the ground, the MC at our wedding said that Kim in her dazed state thought Ken said, oh, will you marry me? And instead of misunderstanding, I said, will you be mad at me? Yeah, that's his story anyway.
You said, have you seen a tightless four? She said, it's over there.
I lost it.
It's just under the tree over there.
I lost that ball.
Did you?
No, yeah, never found it. I mean, what was it? Yeah.
You would think she would have kept her eye on it.
Hopeless.
Huh?
Hopeless.
Kim, come on. Please. Okay. What about Hogan's caddy, the stories of him going out and catching them with a towel and stuff and not have to move more than a step and all this sort of stuff?
Oh, that was the same as practicing next to Greg Norman and his caddy with a baseball glove. And,
you saw that?
Oh, it was practicing next to him. I was once at the Queensland Open, it was, and that was just incredible to witness that.
How good they were.
Well, it was also, when your caddy sort of, stepping right, left, and, you can see the comparative difference. Yeah, it was pretty impressive.
I'd need 30 caddies. Right, rough.
My caddy was the skinny one. He was running a bit.
That's right. You lost a lot of weight. Okay, so you're now a tour. You're a pro.
Mm.
They had tour school back then, even in Australia and all that sort of stuff, right? So you had to get a card. Like, for you to go and play in Australia, Asia.
No, you make a cut and you get into the next event. That's how it worked then.
So pre-qual?
Pre-qual.
On a Monday?
Mm.
Right. So tee it up.
Yep.
If you go any good, you get in.
Yeah, make the cut, you get to the next event.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
You're married, you're traveling and playing, you're playing in New Zealand. Tell us about your caddy at Titiringi.
Oh, well, that was my first New Zealand event, and I was pulling my own trundler because, young guy starting out, trying to make ends meet, cover costs, etc. This young guy and his mother were watching me play from behind the ropes, and he actually said to me, "Oh, would you like a caddy?" And I said, no, I'm okay. And then a few holes later, he asked me the same question, and I thought, oh, why not? So anyway, I said, look, it's yours. So he took the bag. It was only, it would have been 4'11". And he took the bag off the trundler, and the bottom of the bag is dragging on the ground. The spectators are laughing at him. And, he put the buggy aside. He wanted to be a real caddy, this kid.
Yeah,
he
was
a great, great little kid. Anyway, after the event, I made the cut, did okay. And then after the event, hanging around the 18th green, he just said to his mum, Ken's staying at our place next year. Like this. And his mum said, okay. Anyway, the next year I went over, and he's only 15. And I arrived at the airport. I got my bag and golf bag off the carousel, and he greeted me. I said, where's your mother? And he says, no, I'm driving you home. Little kid, he's only about, he's 5 foot now.
Yeah.
And he had to put a pillow on the seat to see over the dashboard, and he's driving me home.
You're kidding.
So he drove an hour and a half south of Auckland to Te Kauwhata, where they lived on this little, farm.
Yeah.
And then he'd organised everything. He'd organised for us to stay at his uncle and auntie, Max and Nairi, near Titiringi. He caddied for me there. And every New Zealand Open I played in after that, he caddied for me. He came down to Wellington, and we played a parapet. Oh, funny story. I got to hear this on the caddies get excited about holding putts.
Yeah.
Or, prospectively making more money.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was on the 12th at Paraparam, and we'd seen these gliders flying around on our way to the event. And I said, oh, would it be good to do that one day, wouldn't it? And we were just looking at them and talking about it. And anyway, I was on the 12th, out about a 50-footer. So it was a par five, so I'm putting for eagle from 50 feet. Richard's holding the flag. His name's Richard Pryor.
Yeah,
same as the comedian.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's holding the flag, and I've got this 50-foot putt, and I said, hey, Richard, if I hold this, you're paying for the glider flights this afternoon.
You're kidding.
Anyway, I've hit this putt. It rolled.
You're saying miss.
And it rolls in, this eagle putt. Anyway, he's just held the flag up in one hand. He's looking down in the hole, and he's just speechless.
It went in.
And normally caddies and players get excited about it, but he was not excited. So we went.
He didn't want to glide.
He didn't want to pay for the glider flight.
And you went.
We went.
Wow. But you've never done it before.
I had a little stint in Tassie, but that was just with a fellow I played with in Pro-Am who took me out one day, but it was an old tinny thing, but this one was a real competitive one, so it was a really good one.
A little tinny thing. You got on a little tinny glider in Tasmania.
Glider, yeah. So
that's anyway, a good idea.
But then it was great.
Wow. So,
but yeah, Richard caddy for me on every New Zealand event, and anyway, he was in Australia one day, and I arrived back from Norfolk Island quite late, and I arrived back 11 o'clock at night and had to tee off on the Griffith Pro-Am the next day. So Kimmy, my wife, said, oh, you're wasting your time going. So I had an 11:30 tee time. So we got up at 3 o'clock. Richard jumped in the car. He hadn't been to Australia before. And drove my old Tirana to Griffith. And anyway, when we got past the mountains, he said, why are all these sheep brown? He'd never seen brown sheep.
That's funny.
Anyway, and I won the event. I rang my wife and I said, yeah, well, see, it was worthwhile going.
I made made another $3,000, honey.
But Richard's story is amazing. He ended up a chef and then designing kitchens. And he and his girl then put in for a job with the fourth richest man in the world. And Prince from Abu Dhabi or whatever, anyway. And one particular time, the prince sent him in his private plane. So Richard and his wife's job was to cook meals for this prince on the plane. That was their sole job. And one particular time, the prince just said, I'm putting you on the jet. I'm sending you off to another country. And he had a big sack with him. And Richard arrived in this country, and they got off at the airport, collected their luggage, and went to customs. And the customs people opened up the cash, and there was $50,000 US in it cash. Anyway, the prince sent Richard along to give it to Colonel Gaddafi and said, you are cooking meals for Colonel Gaddafi.
Really?
So he was there as Colonel Gaddafi's chef. And eventually finished there and opened up his own business called Private Flight. And he cooks or now has offices throughout the world, and he's providing meals for wealthy people who have their own airplanes.
When was the last time you spoke to him?
Saw him a few months ago. We contact each other when he's in Australia, and obviously Facebook's pretty good. And he's locked up in New Zealand anyway, but we keep in touch.
Golf, it's an amazing game, the people you meet.
Mm.
If when people talk to me about golf, the first thing, it's not about tournaments, blah, 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 not that I did any good anyway, but the people you meet, your story so far, backpacking overseas, and the people you've got, Albert Wallace, that you've got all these people that you meet, that you stay in. One thing that stands out already is you stay in contact with them all.
Yes. Well, one of my really good friends now is Alan Davidson, the cricketer.
Yeah.
And I was a youngster in Narrandera, I happened to be the junior cricketer of the year when I was 11 years old, and 132 runs, 20 wickets, and 11 catches. I'll never forget that. Anyway, but I got a nickname from that, Sam, after Sam Trimble, the famous cricketer.
Yeah.
So that's my nickname. And we played in the Davidson Shield as a representative of Narrandera, and
it was named after him.
Correct.
Your mate.
Correct, Alan Davidson.
That's
and
cool.
Then Ron Luxton was employed by Alan Davidson. So when I moved to Sydney, Alan, being a member of Concord, introduced me to Concord. And then I sat in his office as a kid, and I'll never forget it, coming on one of those country trips or city trips from the country. And St. Martin's Tower, sitting in Alan's office, and I thought, oh, wow, how good's this? And then anyway, so Alan introduced me to Concord, and we became quite friendly. And then one particular day I said, Alan, would you like to have a game of golf with me on June the 14th, which was my birthday? And Alan said, look, no, I'm busy, but I just want to have a game with him because I really appreciate what he'd done for me as a kid, you know. And yeah. Anyway, I said, oh, that's a shame. And I said, oh, what's happening? He said, oh, it's my birthday. We have the same birthday. Right. We have the same birthday. So we've had lunch every year on our birthday, and we played golf every year on our birthday.
It's cool, isn't it?
Mm, terrific.
1990 is a big year for you. You came off a big finish in 88 at the Australian PGA at Riverside Oaks. Mm. That wasn't the Ricky May.
That was the Australian PGA.
Right. What was the Ricky May? That was a tournament at, remember that?
David Merriman won that.
Yeah. Mm. Did they play it just once, did they?
I think so, yeah.
The Ricky May Classic.
Correct.
I remember it. I went out there. Mm. So let's go forward to 1990. You win the New South Wales Open. Mm-hmm. Is that Bathurst?
That's right. First time they took it to the country.
Right. That would have been big for a country boy to win in the country.
Well, it was because it was all about Peter O'Malley.
Right.
And Peter and I played together the last day, so it was a real head-to-head battle. And
what did you shoot the last day? Do you remember?
Oh, I shot 10 under for the event, but I can't remember what I shot the last day.
Did you hit it over the
jail?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh. I've never played Bathurst.
Oh, haven't you?
Beautiful golf course.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
But it was absolutely magnificent condition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love those country courses. And you won the, what's the Old Links Challenge?
Oh, that was the Bolton Old Links Challenge.
What's that?
It's a secondary tour event in the UK.
Right.
And Kim and I stayed at the Black Dog Inn at Belmont. And in this lovely little room, and we went to dinner, and Jim Pilkington owned the he was a publican.
Yeah.
We looked at the menu, and I said, Jim, what's this black pudding on the menu? And Jim said, that's congealed pig's blood in sausage. Like this, is that a better accent?
No, not bad.
Okay. Not bad. Anyway.
What was that? What accent? That was, English?
Well, kind of English, yeah. Anyway, I'll have to work on it. But anyway, I said, well, the only way I'm ever having that is if I win this week. Anyway, I fired up. I had a course record there, I think second round. So I shot 18 under for the event anyway. And the morning we were about to leave, Jim served this giant slab of black pudding on this plate. And he said, you said you'd eat it.
He's Indian now. And did you eat it?
Yeah, when you've been all around, you get all these accents, right?
Anyway, yeah. Did you eat it?
I ate it.
And what was it? Pig's blood.
Oh, congealed pig's blood in sausage. Black pudding. Yeah, it's not very Moorish.
Doesn't sound good. Mm. You play the 90, because you've already played one British Open, one Open Championship in 90.
St. Andrews.
Then you play, that's right, that year. And then you play another Open Championship at Muirfield. So you played in two majors.
Four rounds.
You played four rounds of the British Open. Who did you play with in some of those Opens? Do you remember? Anyone worth?
Dennis Durnian and Gavin Levinson. And I actually played with in the Open at Muirfield with Barry Lane and Gordon Brand Jr. And Gordon Brand Jr. was leading. And
he had a mo?
Yes.
He would have liked your mo.
Yeah, mine was more mature than his.
Yeah. He had a mo, I remember.
He did.
And the other European player with a mo, Rafferty? What was his name?
Ronan Rafferty. Back to my backpacking.
Back to the mo or?
Back to my backpacking.
Yeah.
When I was working for that photographer, he sent me up to top of the stands and I walked along the fairway and Jack and Seve were playing around together. And they walked into that arena where you, the last hole arena of the British Open, and the applause was amazing. And I'll never forget that. That was, to me, that was quite inspirational to me wanting to pursue golf. And when I was playing with Gordon Brand Jr., who was leading, every seat in the stand was full, and we walked into that arena, and I hit a 2-iron to about 20 feet inside Barry and Gordon. And I just never forget that experience of actually walking into that arena. And it, yeah, it wouldn't have mattered. It didn't matter to me whether I was winning or making the cut or whatever. It was just the fact I was playing. It was just amazing.
Well, not many people get to even go to an Open Championship, let alone play in it, let alone, you know, get to experience that. They reckon the Waste Management Open over in Phoenix, that's just grown and grown. They reckon playing that par three, you know, that famous par three they play?
Yes.
They reckon it's unbelievable.
Well, the good thing about that, that's open to the townsfolk.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's great. They reckon it's huge. Mm. Okay. Mike Clayton.
Yeah, go on.
you just start smiling. I don't know Clates. I'm going to get him on the show one day. Mm. But what you tell a funny story, something with his putter at Sunningdale or something. Tell us.
I don't know whether I should tell you.
Would he be offended? Don't be offended, Clates. It's all good.
Well, I don't think you could offend Mike, could you?
I don't know him. Look. But let's say no, you can't. So keep going.
Well, for all the people that know Mike, I would have said he's quite unflappable, but this particular occasion, we were playing together in the European Open.
Yeah.
And anyway, the front nine at Sunningdale, I fired up and I had 29, so two eagles if I remember. And anyway, Michael said, come on, you break the course record, whatever, whatever, whatever. And anyway, on the 12th hole there, and I was about to walk to my ball and I hear this, whew, 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 whew. Oh, someone's thrown a club. And Mike had thrown a club, so he wasn't having a great day. But anyway, further on, we get to the 17th hole and we're both on for two, but Michael, he three putted. Anyway, we're walking to the 18th tee. Got hold of his putter. He still had his putter in his hand. Just threw it at the bin. And there's spectators all around the tee. And one fella said, no, I'm not going to try the accent again. But he just said, I'll have it if you don't want it. And Mike said, if it's in one piece when I finish, you're going to have it. Anyway, we both hit off up the fairway. And for some unknown reason, I think it's still, I've never seen Mike look shocked before, but I think there was a state of shock in his face. It's one of the funniest things I've seen. Where he took about three or four paces. He just gave this putter the biggest throw. And he held on too long. And it's now helicoptering toward the 17th green. There's a guy in the bunker playing his shot.
You're kidding.
It must have flown 40 or 50 metres in the air, this putter. And lands thwack right at the guy's feet.
You're kidding. And there was, everyone went quiet.
Oh, yeah.
It was an
accident. Yeah.
It's like Caddyshack.
Well, he held on too long.
It's like Caddyshack.
But when I looked at Mike's face, there was just this, what have I done, look on his face, you know, anyway. But
I'm defending him. It was an accident. he was passing it, I'm assuming.
Mm.
He was passing it to that guy that asked for it, and it's gone in the wrong direction.
That's what it was.
Like Caddyshack. Do you know when Judge Smales is – yeah, no – Danny Noonan's caddying for Judge Smales, and he's passing it to someone. It goes and ends up in the clubhouse. Remember?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Same thing. And then
apologies, Mike.
Yeah. No. Well, he didn't do anything wrong. The nicest bloke you played with on tour. If someone said, "Who's the nicest bloke you ever played with?"
Oh, that's a good question. Oh, I thought Nick Price was. Certainly comes to mind. Lovely, lovely guy.
Biggest knob. Who was someone you could easily not talk to again?
No comment.
No one.
No, too nice. I'll keep that to myself. Yeah.
Too nice a bloke. Yeah. Okay, you had a you've told me something about a Jack Newton, I think it was an 8-iron at Royal Melbourne. You had a hole in one.
That's right, yeah. But back to Jack. I mean, I do owe a lot to Jack because I used his golf equipment and he arranged my first sponsor invitation to Europe. So when I secured my card there, he actually got me an invite into the Bench Snedgers International, and I shot 73, 74, made the cut by a couple, and third round I fired up and broke the course record. So, yeah, felt, you know, Jack's decision was justified then. So, yeah, thanks, Jack.
And what goes around comes around, right? Because I know I'm going to interview Jack soon on the show, but he I want to talk to Jack about the Von, Norman Von Nieder took Jack under his wing, and it's a flow-on effect, right? You know, like the Von was a great player, obviously went to Europe, took Jack over there, then Jack takes you under his wing, and it just keeps going on. So tell us about did you say it was the first hole-in-one, you think, on the –
Yeah, I was told that at the time by Michael Frank, who was the general manager, and he had done some research and said that he believed it to be the first hole-in-one ever to be had in a tournament at Royal Melbourne.
That's big.
Well,
it's
that's
probably like the Mike Weird.
Yeah, probably not one true. Of those tall stories. Yeah. Anyway,
we'll have to do an apology follow-up interview.
I think so. Yeah.
It'll be 16 or 17.
Yeah, but yeah. Anyway, it was an 8-iron, Jack Newton 8-iron, and the flag was sitting just over the bunker on the right, a little par 3 up the hill, 7 on the composite course, and the stand was full of people, and it was just went in the hole, and all these people put their arms up, and I thought, wow, how cool is that?
So I've asked you before, prior to the interview, if you had to hang one of your golf clubs up, well, let's give you two. Behind the bar somewhere. Let's say there's we put together a golf pub and Ken Trimble has to hang two golf clubs up. We're going to hang that one up?
Yes.
And we're going to hang the one iron at Duntry League.
And a Norman Von Nieder club that I first had when I played golf.
I gave you two clubs.
No, I got three.
Now you got three.
Yeah, I got three.
You're only supposed to have one.
Well, I have to widen the bar.
Wow. Okay. Now, before we carry on with the interview, we're going to do, for the first time, we're going to do a quick nine questions, quick. Don't elaborate, just give me the answers straight up. Okay? So, your favorite movie of all time?
Lord of the Rings.
Who would play Ken Trimble in a movie?
Kevin Costner.
Steak or seafood?
Seafood.
America or Europe?
Europe.
If you had to play one course every day for 12 months, same golf course?
Augusta.
Beer or wine?
Beer, home brewer.
You know what the GOAT is? You know what the GOAT stands for?
Greatest of all time.
Tiger or Jack? Can't elaborate. Can't explain why. Just who
Jack,
is it?
Jack.
Favorite album of all time?
Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell.
2 out of 3 ain't bad. That's a great song.
Mm-hmm.
Something not many people know about KT.
I have to elaborate.
On this one?
Yes.
All right. Where you go?
Chinese heritage.
Really? That's where that accent gets mixed up.
That's the problem. So my great-great-great-
Could have
great,
been Mandarin in there.
Great-great-granddad. Do you mind if I elaborate?
Yeah, go for it.
Great. I think it might be another great granddad. He emigrated to Australia, I think, around Gold Rush time. And anyway, passed the Young name on down, which became Young, I think, probably under pressure at the time to change his name to maybe fit into the local community.
Yeah.
Anyway, became Young. And my dad used to tell a yarn that our great-great-great-great-great-granddad used to fight the Mongols and save China years ago. Anyway, one day I was in the pro shop at Concord, and I just jokingly said to one of the Chinese members, I said, "We're related." And he said, "How so?" And I said, "My family name, ancestry is Jung." And he just strangely just turned his head and walked away. And 2 weeks later, he came back into the shop, and he'd done some research. And he came and he bowed. And he said, you're descendants of General Yang, who fought the Mongols and saved China.
Is this a true story?
True story. And I thought, wow, Dad was right. It wasn't actually my great-great-great-granddad. It was actually he was descendant of General Yang. And
But you thought your dad was making this up or possibly making it up.
All the while I thought he was making it up, but it turns out we're descendants of great Chinese warriors. Yeah, there you go.
I don't think any of your dad's stories were tall story yarns. I think your dad was telling the truth the whole time. You just thought he was telling stories.
Well, no, he did say he emigrated to Australia in early 1700 before Captain Cook got here. So you got that mixed up.
Might be true. He might have been older than you think. Yeah. Okay. Now, let's talk about something that is an important part of your story. You're a professional golfer. Mm-hmm. You've won golf tournaments. Things are going good. You're traveling the world, married to a great girl. You've started a family. James, your second, was born in 95. So things are going good, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember, what year was the New South Wales Open at Ryde Para?
92.
Okay, so a couple of years before. So I've jumped ahead a little bit too far. So I was there that day, by the way, the final round.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Patton played.
Correct.
Do you remember?
Yeah, with the tobacco-chewing Chris Patton.
He was a big boy.
Yes, yeah.
And it was hot.
It was.
I'm thinking, how's this bloke getting around this golf course, walking it? He was a big boy.
Mm.
I think he was a U.S. amateur champion or something.
I think you're right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was a flusher. But so you're playing the New South Wales Open. I looked up to you. I looked up to Parry a lot. What year did Paz finish second in the Masters?
92.
Got to be around the same time, right?
Mm. He was number 15 in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've got a lead with a few holes to go.
Mm.
So I'm coming out on the golf course to watch you win. And it is what it is. You didn't win. You end up in a playoff. And Paz wins the event. And tell us about the impact that had on you.
Well,
because you're going to win there and go back to Europe, right?
Correct.
Yep.
So the next week I was flying back to Europe to play. Yep. And you know, trying to play two tours is not an easy thing to do. So there's not a lot of sort of lead time. But on that 14th hole, on that final day, I had a one-shot lead, and Craig pulled his second shot into the bunker, par four.
Were you playing together?
Playing together.
Yeah.
And I hit it to about 15 feet, and Craig, annoyingly, holed his bunker shot.
Bastard. not unexpected.
And, well,
from
true,
him.
True, but, yeah.
But that's a big shock to you. Like,
yeah, well, I hadn't been in that position often enough to know how to deal with it. And, anyway, I actually three-putted. And so he took a two-shot lead.
Probably out of shock. You're like, if he doesn't get this up and down, this is going to change.
Correct.
Right.
So I regathered myself, and I birdied the next two. So I birdied 15 and 16, and he bogeyed one of those. So I went back to a two-shot lead. And I stood in the 17th. I'll never ever forget it. And if anyone's listening and ever gets in this situation ever, just learn from other people's errors or just don't do it. Just don't start making your speech and holding the trophy before you've finished, which is exactly what I did. And I thought I'll just play it safely up the middle, and just went out of just way out of my own game plan.
Yeah.
And just got complacent, and before I knew it, I'd lost. So,
tell us about the excavator or something at Ride Para that week. You ended up in an excavator. You asked me how I knew this. How do I know this?
How do you know this?
Can't remember.
Because anyway, so on that 17th hole, which I three putted again, not that it was the green's fault, it was my fault, and to an extent, probably a little my caddy because he didn't sort of recognise the emotion at the time, so he should have calmed me down and whatever, and just said get back on your game plan anyway.
Always the caddy's fault.
Ultimately my fault. Anyway, I years later, I'd obviously secured the job at Concord, and Ross Watson had done a great redesign of Concord Golf Club, and anyway, I got to chat to Ross a lot during that period, and he was doing a redesign of Ride Parramatta, and I said to Ross, look, when you're doing that 17th hole, could you give me a call? I'd love to,
rip it up.
Pay back that hole and rip it up, just as a bit of, what do you call it?
Yeah, payback. Payback. Angry payback.
Payback, yeah. And, I feel like I've, made amends or whatever. Anyway, one particular day I was in the pro shop and Ross telephoned me and said, Ken, what are you doing in the next 20 minutes? And I said, I'll be over. So I jumped in the car. I was there in probably 10 minutes and raced out to the 17th green. And Ross said, well, here it is. Here's the dozer. And he just showed me these two or three levers and he said, no, jump up there, go on, away you go. And anyway, I was shoveling this green.
Beautiful.
Just destroying it. And, you spend your life fixing pitch marks and so forth. So I was totally against the grain. And here it was. I spent about 20 minutes just ripping apart this green. It was great.
Feel good?
Oh, feel great.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And that was a long time after.
Yeah, I don't – OH&S, I don't think they looked on – yeah, okay.
Don't worry about that. Yeah. So you lose there.
Mm.
You would have been in shock. You would have been pretty devastated to with two-shot lead with a few holes to go.
Two to play, yeah.
And then you lose to your mate.
Yep.
I remember the playoff. There was a playoff down that first hole.
Yeah, I was gone mentally when I went into that.
Right.
So, yeah. I think Craig won on the third hole, if I remember.
Can't remember. Then you head to Europe.
Mm.
Who suggested to you to get a new coach?
Craig and I had a mutual friend who sadly passed away, Brian Gray, and Brian made a suggestion that I should look at a coach. And look, at the end of the day, it was probably the right decision but the wrong time. Ronnie was the guy that started me off in golf. Ronnie Luxton gave my first golf lesson at 13 and just looked after my game all the way to where I was. And obviously I had some talent. And but Ron was, in Australia. I was in Europe and I needed some maintenance.
And you didn't have these days you can jump on Skype or there's all sorts of things. You didn't have any of that. Glenn, mobile phones.
Glenn, it was amazing. And only this morning I did a FaceTime golf session with Georgia in South Carolina, and when I was playing in Europe, I was sponsored by Akai, and James gave me a wonderful, wonderful camera, and I had Kim video my swing. I took the cassette out, put in a post pack, posted it to Ronnie, and 3 weeks later I got an answer. And here I am this morning doing a FaceTime session. Like George has got the AirPod in. I'm thinking, it's unbelievable, isn't it? Technology, amazing.
And you think if you grew up, like I've seen the superimposed track band behind Hogan. I don't know if you've ever seen that photo. But what Hogan did back in the day, with the shut-off stands with different clubs and all this sort of stuff, without the technology, I often think I'd love Hogan, being a massive Hogan fan, for him to have to hit balls in front of TrackMan and see the data and stuff. He would be blown away.
You said I couldn't elaborate on Tiger and Jack, but I think Tiger nowadays, because technology is just equipment and you know, video, et cetera, has brought players so much closer together that makes Tiger so much more, you know, superior in that sense.
This is a short break to announce the chance for you, the listeners, to win some rare cases of liquid amber. MyBottleShop.com and Yardage Book Yarns have teamed up to create a unique competition called MyBottleShop.com 36 or Better. MyBottleShop.com has over 14,000 products online. Can you imagine? 14,000. They deliver all over Australia and have everything you could ever imagine. Every fortnight, we will give away 3 cases of James Squire's Boutique Beer. All you have to do to enter is have 36 points or better in a social or club comp, visit one of the Yardage Book Yarn social pages and post your name, course, score, and you'll automatically go in the draw. Winners will be contacted directly by mybottleshop.com. Now, back to the show. What do you think about where's the game headed with Bryson DeChambeau? And I mean, he's gone on this journey of bulking up, getting stronger, going to hit it further. He's come out and he's won the US Open. A kid's going to grow up. Like everyone's saying that Tiger invented the gym for golf and all that, but Norman was doing it back in the 80s.
Bernard Langer.
Yeah. So they were the pioneers, Langer, Norman, getting fit and strong, because it wasn't really the thing to do. And the game's changed so much. You think back in, like we mentioned, Jack Newton, Seve, Nicholas Watson, when the players used to hang out together, stay together, hang out together, have dinner. It's changed so much, isn't it? So these days, from the players that I've talked to, it's quite common that they don't even interact at all. They go to tournaments with an entourage. They're there to do a job, to play. And, you know, there might be a small group of players that hang out, but generally it's turned into much more of a business. It's about money. It's about performance.
Which is a little sad, because the camaraderie you develop over the years is just, you know, invaluable and precious to you.
Yeah, exactly. So where do you think the game's headed? Are these kids going to grow up in the gym, bulking up, all about hitting it further?
Oh, I think the kids that I'm coaching now, the parents are certainly looking for that edge. And, you know, if Bryson keeps winning, then you may find that the trend will be for kids to, you know, choose to bulk up and change the way their equipment is as well.
Time will tell, won't it?
It will.
Time will tell. If it works, everyone will do it. Like if there's a majority of the players, then kids will start doing it.
Well, everyone went to Metal Woods, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. Let's go back to your game. When you lost your game, so you went to Europe, changed coaches, it really got bad, didn't it?
There were a couple of circumstances there. One was certainly my decision to change my golf swing mid-season, and that was probably the most, mismanaged decision that I've ever made. It was, you know, and the fellow I went to, very reputable coach, and, you know, it certainly wasn't his fault. It was solely my own for actually choosing to change something that was 20 years of age, as a golf swing is, or was at the time. And so I made that decision. My wife and I drove down to his home club in Kent and spent 2 hours on the range. And it was, I just drove back to London with the biggest smile on my face. I thought, how good's this, you know, and thought I'd found the answer. And but on the range as a good player, you can sort of adapt and there's no pressure attached. And but 10 days later, I had to tee off in the British PGA and it didn't quite work. But anyway.
And talk to me a bit about the emotion. Would you say your golf, when it got the low of lows, because you hide behind that smile, I would assume, to a degree, coming from the country, you wouldn't want to complain and whinge about things. Would you say you got depressed through that period? Because there's a difference between, and one of the things I want to do with this show is try and get rid of the stigma of mental health in men in particular. Would you say you were depressed at times?
Oh, I still am.
Right.
In you know, obviously a minute element in my mind that says, well, what could have been if I hadn't made that decision, you know? So, and that's the reality of golf is that you can never stop playing, you know?
Yeah.
It's not like a footballer who might do a knee or come to the end of his career at 35 or whatever, but as golfers, you can continue playing. So it's something that sort of lives in the back of my mind and
you live with it.
I live with it, and I think I'd probably be the only golf pro in probably the world that doesn't watch golf on Fox Sports because I just find it very difficult to do.
Right, because it's it must be harder for someone like you who's achieved what you've achieved and you've been up towards the top. I compare that to me. I was never that good. So it's got to be easier for me. Like I lost my game to a degree, but it's got to be easier to stop playing when you haven't played on a world tour. Whereas for you, you've been there. So it's a bigger fall, if you like. Would you agree?
Oh, it was massive because for a couple of reasons. One, it was it's all I knew.
It was
my life, and the other reason was that I couldn't find the reason. So I went to various specialists and sports psychologists, and yeah, there's another factor in there which I will add. Yeah, I never really talk about, but it was one that on one particular occasion, Kim and I were traveling from London to the next venue, and this was after I gave the new swing away. I decided I'd sort of shelve it because I just couldn't change, and that's when I played with Clates at the European Open, and I fired up. I'd say 29 on the front nine. I thought, oh, I'm back.
Yeah,
and then. Fun enough, can I interject with something? Because it might be religiously related as well, because Kim and I, we befriended the Southern Baptist.
Yep.
And they said, oh, look, we're having a Bible study at Mark McNulty's house. Anyway, so we decided to join them. So because American wives used to travel and my wife traveled, a lot of the Australian pros, they had their houses in Europe, so the wives would stay in London or whatever. So we just kind of convenient that we hung around with the Americans.
Yep.
And anyway, so we went along to the Bible study at Mark McNulty's house. That's where I earned the nickname Hoover because they had all this pizza there, and I just thought, oh, well, this is nice. So I kept eating the pizza. And they said, where's Ken? Oh, he's still in the kitchen eating the pizza, you know. But we sat, Jesper Barnevik was at the Bible study. I think Danny Miovic and some of these. Oh, who else was there? Oh, of course, Steve Bowman and
Langer.
No, he wasn't there at this one. But anyway, I then went out to play in the European Open. I'd 65. I thought, God, this Bible study's all right. So
I don't know if you know that you just said God at the start of the bit.
Yep. Anyway, the next tournament was in Belgium, and I thought, oh, I've got to make it to this Bible study. got to go again because I had my best finish. I finished, I think, at 12th in the European Open or whatever it was, and I thought I'll go to the Bible study again. So I made a special effort to go to the Bible study on the Wednesday night, and I walked into the room, and there's Bernard. There's this guy.
There he is.
I caused him to miss that 3-footer at Troon when I was wearing the red jumper. There I was fixing his putter in the back of the pro shop at Concord, and there he is sitting at the table. He said, do you want to share my Bible? And I was sitting there sharing Bernard's Bible, and I thought, wow, I'd love to tell you about Concord and Troon, but anyway, I never did because
he wouldn't remember you. Like,
there's no way. Anyway, that I didn't bother him anyway. So we went on with the Bible study thing, and anyway, I went out and I fired up again. So now I'm playing with Chucky Fowler the last day, and Chucky said, "You played great today," and we had the same score because Chucky, my God, he's got a good short game. But anyway, another top 20, and I thought, wow,
this is it.
I got to keep going. So the next tournament, we drove up to Hamburg for the German Open. It was anyway. That was the Honda Open in Hamburg, I think outside of Hamburg. And anyway, I was staying at some pension out the back of nowhere. And anyway, the Bible study was in the city of Hamburg at some hotel. And I thought, oh, no, I've got an early tail. I'm not going to make it. I'll miss the cut.
Are you kidding?
So I think, for some reason, it might have been a little bit of divine intervention the previous 2 weeks. But then the German Open came along, and I was going to tell you about just an incident which kind of flexed on where my game was. And Kim and I were traveling to the Germans about 2 or 3 weeks afterwards. And I was carrying my luggage and her luggage. So we used to put all our luggage in one bag. So being a country boy, I put the golf bag over one shoulder and I'm carrying the suitcase down the steps of Oakwood Station. And my shoulder just went pop. Anyway, I just felt this twinge in my shoulder. And that week, I hit three woods along the ground. I've never done that in my life.
In pain?
No, just a dead feeling. It's kind of I had to shake my arm around and whatever, a little like, I think, dead arm that skiers
right,
get.
Right, yeah.
Anyway, so from that point onwards, it became a concern. And anyway, I sort of started developing these shots that came out of the blue and disappeared off the planet, you could say. Anyway.
Chivalry cost you your golf game.
It did.
If you made Kim carry all the gear,
yeah,
or you were rich enough to, Albie Lewis would have paid for.
Yeah. Well, that was a thing. I got to a level as a player, just didn't quite break through. So you'd have the porter or the private jet anyway.
Well, Seve and those guys, they would have never been going to get a sore shoulder because they're winning majors. And
but that's life. You deal with it. And I came back to Australia and I sought, sports psychologists. I went to EEGs. I had two neurologists I went to, and I just couldn't work out what this feeling was in my arm. And it was like this numb feeling. I used to write letters to my sponsors and that. I'd write three paragraphs and had to shake my arm around. It just didn't feel like it worked anymore.
You still have it?
Still have it. Yeah,
oh, so, I didn't know that. So so you live with a...
Yeah, it was like a professor over at Chatswood diagnosed as a supraspinatus tendon rupture or whatever.
Right.
And I tried all these exercises. I even went to Alan Jones. One of my Mazda sponsors, Phil Clark, actually organized a meeting with Alan Jones for just for some motivational hypey. That's what he thought I needed. So anyway, I sat with Alan for 3 hours. It was absolutely amazing.
Really?
And just the two of us, and he chatted about the things. And he's an amazing guy, what he does for sports people. And every respect for him. And
That's cool.
Mm.
I didn't know that. I've met Alan, intelligent guy, eh?
Mm.
So what would you do differently? You would manage, knowing that for starters, that very day, you would just manage your...
Oh, I would have probably, after losing that play after Paz, probably just gone fishing for a week.
Yeah.
Get it out of my head and just get on.
Keep
with
going.
Because, obviously as coaches now, you sort of understand the relationship the brain has with the body and so forth, and you try and change something that is, I guess... so ingrained, and you try and change that in a short period of time. Just as
it would hold you in a good stead. It's invaluable what you can give as we're both full-time coaches. You can give something extra or something special, and that's, you've done it. You've been there under pressure. Mm-hmm. You've pre-qualified. You've led tournaments. You've won tournaments. Mm-hmm. You've missed cuts. That's something that you as a coach, you can't buy. It's something special that you can give a lot of young players, a lot of young elite players, which is fantastic.
It is. And as I say to most of my pupils now, when I was first taken into the video room by the fellow who tried to help me with my game, and he drew these lines on a screen. I'd never seen these lines in my life. And I didn't say anything to him because I didn't want to appear naive unintelligent or whatever. But I actually walked out of the room not really understanding what he was
telling me.
And he just said, do this, whatever. And I went out in the range and I did that repetitively. And it was amazing. It worked beautifully. But I didn't understand. So I make it a norm now to say to my pupils, if you don't understand what I'm telling you, please ask me.
Yeah. The other thing is, you may have needed, so, going back to what you said before, you've met this coach, you might have been on the right track, but you might have needed 2-3 months of a bit of rest and a bit of practice and more access to him. And because you probably played an event where you had one or two lessons and then went and played. Is that how it went down? So how long did you have to work on your game after?
10 days.
Yeah, that's just crazy.
Yeah, and I hit 4 4-irons out of bounds.
That's crazy.
At the British PGA, and I thought, whoa, where'd that come from? But I had to give it away because I just couldn't play like that. And
but you didn't have enough time to...
Well, we didn't, because I was playing the Australian Tour as well.
Crazy.
And so, when I... And then, I had a little purple patch there afterwards where, the European Open, et cetera. And I flew down to Singapore to support the Singapore PGA, which is a tournament Australia was trying to get on its calendar.
Right,
and and I was leading by about 4 shots, I think, into the last day. Played with Lucas Parsons the last day, and I had a couple of eagles on that last day. So I was really firing up. And then, unbeknownst to me, Terry Gale held a 60-foot putt and chipped in on the last to beat me, and he eventually got me to playoff. So
really?
Same thing happened again, and I just got complacent.
Well, there's another flick of the switch that if you if he doesn't chip in, you win that one.
Exactly. Yeah, career kicks on, you know. So, but yeah, the sort of mental anguish you take away from something like that, even though you're sitting with a wad of cash in your pocket or whatever and think, wow, how good's this? But at the end of the day, it's that fact you learn.
And you come back home. Caitlin was born here?
Yes.
Right. So you come back home and have your third final child.
Mm-hmm. 1998.
So now you're a father of three and you have to transition life as a club pro. You're not playing well. You've still got your contacts at Concord. You're now renowned. Like one of your strengths is you're so likable. So everyone, you were never going to struggle to get a good job. But transitioning to becoming a club pro, that would have been difficult, I'm assuming.
It actually wasn't because I made a decision to just cut off my golf playing. I said, well, you know, I can't keep going for financial reasons and sort of mental reasons as well. So I wasn't dealing very well with it at all. And I learned to deal with it better. And that's actually thanks to Ken Burnt, another golf pro who watched me play in the Coolum Classic. And he afterwards he took me aside and he said, oh, Kenny, you looked at your shoulders. And my shoulders were protruding out past my sternum. Wow. You know, he said, they're so tense. So I made a decision to try and rectify that or address it. So I saw in the community college magazines a Tai Chi course. I went and enrolled for 3 months and it was one of the best things I ever did. And back again and again and again. So it allowed me to deal with the emotion of losing my sort of career or helped deal with the emotion of that. Because you never lose that.
No.
And because as I said before, you know, it's all I had. It's all I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so transitioning was certainly an economic decision. And also, I just wanted, as a golfer, I wanted to be the best I could be. And club pro, I wanted to be the best I could be. So I had to, you couldn't do both. You can't play and be a club pro.
No, not like the good old days back in the 50s weren't really a club pro. You were a player and you popped in the shop. Mm. Whereas now you're a professional and they expect you there.
Correct.
60 hours a week and teach.
Seven.
One person that has been there for you the whole way is your wife.
Mm-hmm.
When you were a trainee, you hit her on the bloody practice fairway, nearly killed her, married her. She's been there before you were a seasoned professional, during it, as you lost your game, as you come back and you're a club pro. She's your number one supporter, I'm assuming?
Oh, without doubt. I mean, as I arrived back in Australia, I had a two pair of pants that fit into the backpack, whatever else I owned, and I think $1,500 to my name. So when I met her, we found out that we're only living 7 minutes apart in Sydney.
Right.
So I went to meet her family and, you know, they turned out to be, you know, basically my Sydney parents at the time. And
Her family. Yeah, right.
So, and this might sound really strange, but when I was looking for somewhere to stay after one of my accommodation places fell through, I actually stayed in their back room and my wife had a unit down the road. So I used to stay with
her. You're kidding. You were living with her parents. I
stayed
with her
parents and Kim stayed down the road in her unit. So it was kind of, but anyway, that lasted a certain while. Yeah, I think she charged me too much board, the mother-in-law.
I wanted to take a short break from the show to let you know about our friends at Brisbane East, Gold Coast and Sydney South Commander Business Centres. If you own or run a business, let them do a health check on your business communications. The worst thing that could happen is you find out that your current deal is okay. And if you sign up at one of these three centres, you'll receive a 50-inch plasma TV. Offering Ericsson LG Solutions, contact one of these Commander Business Centres today. Didn't you say to me once that you went to on holidays for 4 years in a row or something with your in-laws?
No. I think I deserve a medal.
Tell me.
22 years in a row with my in-laws.
You're kidding.
No, 22. And,
they don't listen to podcasts, do they?
No. Oh, they don't have an iPad, thank God. I've tried to give them one.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And where was that to?
Nelson Bay.
22 years in a row.
22 in a row. Yeah.
For a week.
A week.
At least a week.
A week to 10 days. Yeah. Wow. First 3 days were okay, and then
it deteriorates from there. doesn't it?
No, I've got to say. It's a very, very close bond. And, they're wonderful, wonderful people. And, without their stability at the time and me, they were like.
You're just covering yourself now in case they listen to the podcast, don't you? Okay. Sounds like a great family. So how many roles have you had going back to Concord?
Mm.
You played there as a junior and you qualified for something, or that was the regional. Then you would have played pennants. Then you would have won the club championship. Then you're touring pro. Then the club pro. How many roles have you had at Concord?
Whoa.
So let's list them out.
Okay. Well, 1978 was when I was introduced to the club, playing an event there, which was the CHS championship, which I won.
And, so you won that as a junior.
Yeah. Charles Savage taught us how to sign a card or score a card. Or anyway.
Was old Charlie, he was the cricketer?
That was Charlie Richardson.
Richardson.
Started golf when he was 70 years old. He was one of the members there. Yeah.
Yep.
Anyway, so 79 was when I first joined the club.
Yeah.
And once again, introduced by Alan Davidson. And that was toward the end of 79 and July 79. And then then I won the club pro, the junior championship there. Then I went overseas, had that little stint away. So I was basically just kept my membership up.
Yep.
And came back and decided to be a trainee pro, missed the first year. So I was actually a shop assistant.
Right. Yeah.
And that's when I won the club championship and foursomes championship. Then I worked in the kitchen washing the dishes for some extra money. And so that was another role.
Was Shirley there then?
Shirley, yes. Yeah,
Shirley.
And Norma.
Remember Norma?
Yeah.
We used to get free toasted lunches. Used to get free lunches. Used to ring up from the shop. That was the best.
Oh, no. Shirley would ring up and say, boys, lunch is ready.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, that was the best. That was the best accent you've done today.
Thanks.
Shirley, because that was spot on. Lunch. Boys, the lunch is ready. You didn't want Shirley making your lunch. Do you remember they were, if Norma or someone made them, or there was Norma and the, what was the short?
Margaret.
Mark. She was the best.
Oh, she is. She was the best.
But Shirley, she scared me. Mm. She was scary. And she'd slap those sandwiches together, but they were free. They were free, mate. I used to love
them. You've just reminded me of something. Margaret loaned me a book, Power of Positive Thinking. I haven't given it back.
Norman Vincent Peale.
Yeah. That was from 1983, 84.
That's like the Seinfeld episode.
Oh, I'm going to have to give
it back. The Tropic of Capricorn. And when Bookman in Seinfeld, the library guy, chases George Jerry down.
Yeah.
He hasn't returned a book from college, and he owes $6,500 or something for the late fees.
Yeah, so trainee.
That's a good book, though.
Mm.
Jack Newton, I've got a story on that book.
Mm.
And I'll ask Jack about it. True story, I was at Jack's house one day and I'm looking through his library, snooping, and there's The Power of Positive Thinking. And I know the book, I've read it, Norman Vincent Peale.
Mm-hmm.
And I pick it out, because I've read it, I grab it out of Jack's bookcase, and it's got scribble and highlights and notes and everything throughout this book. And I hope Jack doesn't mind. I'm sure it's the truth. So I said, oh, you've read this book. He said, oh, that book, you back in the day, there was no, like, it was a bit of a weakness sort of thing, psychology and all that sort of stuff. So he used to hide it in his suitcase. Like, it wasn't allowed to see the light of day that he was reading that sort of book. And he'd make notes and scribble in it. There was, you know, dog ears through all the pages all that sort of stuff. I've got to ask him that when I interview him.
So, yes, trainee.
Yep. So you've done that. You've worked in the kitchen.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, trainee pro for 3 years.
Yep.
And I got my state invite after 14 months, national invite after 16. So I was, last year or 18 months, I wasn't there a hell of a lot, but I was out playing. But then a few of the members got together when I finished my time and they said, well, Kenny, what's going to happen when you finish your traineeship? And I said, well, I'll have to ask permission to come back, as per normal PJ etiquette, courtesy. And they said, no, we're not having that. So they organised a tournament playing honorary type membership for me, which was extended on through my playing career. So
that's when I met you. And then, now you're the touring pro.
Touring pro. And then after I finished my tournament career, I took a job for 16 months in Mount Broughton. And then the job at Concord was advertised and I took that. So I spent 18 years as the club pro there. And now I coach and I was also made an honorary member, which is really special.
So there's about seven or eight different lives for you at Concord?
Yes.
Plenty.
There might be another one. I don't think.
What's the other one?
No, I'll have to have a little think.
We're going to put your tombstone at the back of the car park or something. There's no more to go.
No.
Well, you might win the Australian PGA Seniors Championship at Concord.
Well,
that's what's going
to
happen.
I'll have to do some practice. But it's a 42-year relationship, so it's a long time.
And Richard's going to caddy for you, your mate from New Zealand.
Oh, Richard Pryor. Yeah, I'll get him over to caddy. That's good.
That's a great name.
That'll work.
That's a great name. Mm. You have built a reputation as a great coach. Now, you wouldn't say that because you're too humble, but that's the truth. How's your why do you think you enjoy coaching so much? Where's that come from?
I just really enjoy helping people, and I regard myself as a people's person. I mean, I was the shyest kid. I wouldn't say boo to anyone, but traveling broadened my horizon and mind, and I came back and I thought, well, golf has given me such a great opportunity to excel in life, if you like, and make a life for myself. And I think the rewards that golf offers, if I can relay those to kids in particular or anyone for that matter, and I just think I've got something to offer there, and whether it be sort of helping people in life's journey or whatever, or just trying to nurture their careers or whatever ideals they want to get out of the game.
Just you reminded me of something. There's two PGA members that come to mind when I think of giving back to the game, in particular, you and Eddie Emerson. Was Eddie from the country?
I couldn't answer that. He spent so many years at St. Michael's, but I don't know.
Yeah, but he used to have a program, initiative, whatever you want to call it, similar to you, where he'd pick up clubs, old secondhand clubs and that, and get them out to the bush. And we used to do a similar thing when I was helping the National Aboriginal Sports Corporation. But the idea was there's so many clubs in the cities, Sydney, and you used to do a similar thing, right? And you used to get clubs from wherever, Concord, someone's going to trade in a set of clubs. You'd say, I know where they're going, straight out to the bush.
Exactly.
And don't worry about the trade-in. You've got enough cash to buy yourself a new set of pings and we'll throw the old set in the back of the van, and they're coming out to Narendra in a couple of months.
Mm.
Beautiful.
Oh, look, it's been a wonderful program to be involved in. And at the end of the day, if we produce one golfer, then to me it's worthwhile.
It's not all about elite either, is it?
Like, no. That's right. That is precisely the reason why myself and Norm Buckley started the program, because our club was very focused on elite players, and a lot of emphasis was placed on trying to win a pennant, producing the best players from around the area to a golf club to win a pennant or bolster the, say, junior ranks, if you like. And I just looked at it and thought, well, I think there could be a balance here. We could support golf at grassroots level and then balance out that whole ethos of the club, in the sense that we weren't seen as a club that is just supporting elite players. And I think there needs to be a greater balance nationwide to do that, because the amount of great golfers that come from country region, we are losing, and other sports have successfully grown their own sport from country regions, grassroots level. And I think we sort of probably missed that opportunity. I think when clubs were full in Sydney, there wasn't that emphasis to actually try and cure kids in country regions. And that's what I'd sort of love to do. I remember our first visit to Grongrong, I just made mention, and one of the kids videoed it, I just made mention that if every metropolitan club could adopt a region, because the amount of equipment that we have put together out of Concord Golf Club has been extraordinary. We've put together 600 sets of clubs minimum, and 500,000 golf balls, bags to match, and buggies, et cetera, et cetera. And the support given by Kennards High through one of the members, Peter Lankin, and just various members who've donated financially to that program. It runs on the smell of an oily rag, and been just a wonderful thing to do. And I remember the first one at Grongrong, we gave the kids a brand new shag bag, Titleist shag bag each. There's all these shag bags sitting there, these farm sheds out at Grongrong.
That's great.
But the whole idea, and it came out of Eddie's program certainly was similar, and how ours evolved was I was doing a presentation at the golf club after their presentation night, and I was driving back to Sydney on my own, and I passed Grongrong Golf Club, and I just saw four people just hitting golf balls, and the dust was flying. It was in the middle of the drought. And I'd been at a match meeting a week before at Concord, and there was a complaint about a bear patch on the side of a bunker. And I thought, this is so out of balance, this game and this country and this whatever. Anyway, and I thought, oh, I wanted to stop my car and give these kids some balls. I had nothing in my car at the time. That 5-hour drive gave me the scope to think about how we could actually put together a decent program to help kids in the country. And, you know, Norm Buckley still has comments when he goes back to Denman about how good it was and where some of the kids have gone, you know, and just to keep them playing the game. We know how great a game it is. It look, keeps kids occupied for longer than most other sports. And as you said before, Glenn, you know, the opportunity to meet some great people and certainly travel the world as I have. I mean, I couldn't envisage life without the game.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And you mature. Well, I certainly did. If you start the game when you're young, you hang around people much older than you, and there's a, I don't know how to even put words to it, but there's an level of maturity, or, you know, some of these people are business people and you're only a kid, but you get to hang out with them and it rubs off on you.
The best way I can explain that is being a club pro as long as I was at Concord, we used to use kids who did what you did, clean the clubs.
Yeah.
So I used to employ these little kids. We called them gophers. We had the word gopher embroidered on their shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the maturity level or the improvement level in their just learning and their just growth was amazing, because they were not forced into, but they had to engage with people of a different age group. And they're very, very special kids to me, because they, you know, most of them still keep in contact.
Yeah.
And I think it's a wonderful environment.
Yeah. And the other thing is, by you, it's similar to what we were saying before, by you taking them under your wing, when they first come to the club, they might feel like, oh, I'm not even worthy to sort of come here or clean the clubs or whatever it might be. Next thing, you're encouraging them to play in the comp or practice, or it's just that it's small increments of belief and confidence.
Yep. Yep.
And you meet people. I remember when I first went to Concord, there was like some members in the corner that no way I would ever go and talk to them. And my mum said to me, you know, the obstetrician or whoever it was that delivered you is a member of Concord. And I don't know if I've ever told you this, Dr. Ralph Foreman.
Yes.
You know Ralph Foreman?
Yes.
So he delivered me. So I went up to this guy and I said, oh, I just mentioned, and he, you know, to me, he was so far beyond talking to him. And I mentioned that my mum said that he delivered me. Oh, he was chuffed. Oh, you got to, I delivered the pro and all this sort of stuff. So all of a sudden I could feel like I could talk to these connection. People. It's unbelievable. Yeah. Where's your golf at? Before we wrap up, there's just a couple more things we're going to talk about. Where's your golf at today? And what would you like it to be moving forward? Golf, do you playing golf? Do you love playing? Do you avoid it at all costs?
I actually get more pleasure playing golf on my own.
Yeah.
And if I get the opportunity just to go out and play a few holes and hit a few balls, I mean, that I get great satisfaction from that. I find golf for me, I don't really say this, but I kind of find it a bit of a waste of time.
Yeah.
Because I don't play at the level I used to.
Yeah.
I think there's better ways for me to spend my time, namely helping others, or just maybe improving my garden at home, or making a better home brew or something like that. I just find that I just play to that elite level, and I just don't like playing at a lesser level.
That's common though, right? Mm. I've read and heard a lot of great players talk about the attention, the focus, the time, and they would probably explain selfishness that goes into being an elite player or sports person, that when it's done and they're not playing like they used to, it's almost like all or nothing. Like, I gave that so much of my life. I don't want to go and hit balls and play, and I just want to get out and do something else with my life, you know?
Yeah, I think it's like you do something so well for a period of time and you want to see things work. You want to see the end result. And when you don't see that end result, you know, it's not satisfactory. So I find personally that if I can grow a nice garden, I see the end result, or I can cook a meal and it's a nice end result, I get great satisfaction out of that. Or I can see a kid progress, or a pupil of any age group. I'm in my youngest pupil's 6, my oldest pupil's 98. It's a 92-year gap. I mean, how great a game is it? But if you can, and my 98 8-year-old said to me not long ago, she said, oh, she was delighted about the fact she lost a shot on a handicap. And I thought, how great a game, you know. So I get great satisfaction out of that. That's, to me, like that result.
Whereas the outcome.
I can go and spend 4.5 hours on the golf course and I think, oh, God, why did I do that to myself?
Yeah.
I know. It's not torture as such, but, you know, the camaraderie is good and I enjoy that part of it. But I just... Yeah, you know how you used to play and you just can't get out of your head. You know, just sits there and just not annoys you, but sort of think, oh, don't replay it, a lesser level.
One thing that's coming up in the future for you, I'm sure, is you're going to be a granddad. How old's your oldest?
27.
So you're going to be, that'll be another stage of life for you, not too far away.
Oh, it will. And look, I'm in a situation now where I can actually spend time with my grandkid.
Yeah.
Well, I will be in a few years, I hope.
Yeah.
And hopefully I can produce a little golfer there. But because I made the decision not to push my own kids into golf, which I don't know whether it's a good decision or not, but I used to see a lot of parents actually drive their kids to the point of child abuse. And I thought, so I don't want to make my kids. Yeah. I'd rather them want actually say to dad, hey, dad, can you teach me how to play?
So. Yeah, I'm the same. KT, we've been talking for over 2 hours. Great story. Before we even started a few weeks ago, you said to me, is there really that much in me to get some stories out on podcast? I can tell you after spending the last 2 hours with you, people are going to love listening to your story from the start to the end. The best thing about you is you're always honest. You call it as it is, which is why I wanted you to be my first ever episode. I've enjoyed it immensely. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Lee. Been great.
You've been listening to another episode of Yardage Book Yarn. Don't forget to share it with your friends, and we'll see you next time.